So today I want to go into more detail about the transthymus action, which we kind of barely touched on last time. So what did we say last time? If I have a 3-manifold, which is a boundary of a 4-manifold, and A is a gauge field on M, and we extend it to N, then the transthymus action of A is equal to integral over the 4-manifold trace FA, wedge FA. So to get this, get more of a handle on this, we want to write this expression here. Trace FA, wedge FA, as a total derivative. So this is just a little mechanical. So FA, although I should ask, how are you guys with differential forms? Okay. So this is dA plus half AA. So trace FA squared, trace dA, wedge dA plus trace AA dA plus 1/4 So we'd like to write this as a total derivative. So the first thing we need to know, we're never going to figure out that the last term doesn't have any derivatives in it. So there's no way the last term is a total derivative. Fortunately, the last term is zero. Okay, so first, because I'm taking a trace, I can move the bracket here to act on the other part. And then if I write this more explicitly, well, this is equal to zero by Jacobi. So what's going on is because we're using differential forms, implicit in all these formulas is like the wedge product. So if you were to unpack the notation and introduce indices, everything is anti-symmetrized here. And so in particular, this term is anti-symmetrized. Which means in particular that we sum over cyclic symmetries. And so it drops out by the Jacobi identity. OK, so what we left with, so trace FA squared is equal to trace dA dA plus dA AA, and this is equal to d of trace A dA plus 1/3 That's d of the Chern-Simons form. Okay. So this is how the, where the Chern-Simons form comes from. You just cook up something, d of which is the square of the field strength. And then there's some kind of elementary algebra which allows you to cook up something else, d of which is the cube of the field strength, and so on. So we're interested in the 3D theory with Lagrangian integral M3 Chern-Simons A times some constant. So we need to know that this is gauge invariant. So there's two steps. Firstly, what happens for small gauge transformations?
Kevin?
Yeah.
So just to summarize yesterday's part and today's part, so we were looking for like a 3D term. And we found the 4D terms that is exact, so like we added this like one term to the 3D part.
Exactly, yeah. So maybe it's worth saying a little more. So like, so we did this little calculation to show that this trace of the square of the field strength is exact. But to do this, you had to assume that my field strength A was globally defined, which is not always the case, right? Because a bundle might have like a field strength in one patch and another field strength in another patch related by a gauge transformation. So those field strengths which are globally defined, you should think of them as being close to zero. So we see for a field strength close to zero, FA squared is exact. If I was to do the same calculation with a more interesting field strength, you would find that trace of f squared is not exact, but it doesn't change if I change my field, my gauge field a little bit. It's a topological invariant of the gauge field. So in a sense, like this formula is slightly misleading because it really only makes sense when I have a global gauge field A. But the action still makes sense by extending it to a four-manifold and doing this trick. Okay, so we want to check this is gauge invariant. Well, we kind of already know it is, but it's nice just to go through it anyway. First, we can check what happens when I do a small gauge transformation. And the harder part is what happens when you do a large gauge transformation. So for the first part, let's look at the Chern-Simons action for A plus delta A. So this is going to be helpful when we study the equations of motion as well, of course, because we want to look at the Euler-Lagrange equations. And let's just plug this in to this expression, ADA plus 1 over 3rd A cubed, If you look at it for a moment, you'll see something interesting. I'm going to get some kind of factor of 2 here, because there's 2 a's and I'm differentiating. And I'm going to get a factor of 3 here, canceling this factor of 1 over 3, because there's 3 a's. So the variation is going to look a lot like the field strength of a, and that's what we're going to find. So. So this is equal to trace of delta A times the field strength of A times 2. And plus D trace. So this second term, I'm moving this derivative here, over here, switching things around. And so I get effectively this term with a coefficient of 2. And then I get this term, which is twice what appears in the field strength. So well, this is going to be really important later, because when I study the equations of motion, we learn that the equations of motion tell me the field strength vanishes. But in any case, how does it help look at gauge invariance? If I do a gauge transformation plus d chi plus a chi, this is equal to D trace plus trace, this is like the covariant derivative of chi. Now, it's great because the first term is a total derivative. And the second term, if I integrate by parts, this moves over here. And the Bianchi identity tells me it's 0. So gauge variation. This is, of course, only for gauge transformations which are near the identity. So what about large gauge transformations? What do I mean by that? So for example, suppose my 3 manifold is the 3 sphere, and suppose my gauge group is SU2, which is also the 3 sphere. And let's take a gauge transformation from S3 to SU2, which is an isomorphism. So for example, in coordinates, it might send xi to the Pauli matrices, you know, on the three sphere, and the Pauli matrices also satisfy that. Okay, so why is this something different? Well, if I have a small gauge transformation which is close to the identity, it can be written as the exponential of some matrix. So it can be continuously connected to the identity. Something like this cannot be continuously connected to the identity. So we'd like to study whether or not the Chern-Simons action is invariant under such large gauge transformations. And we're going to answer that question by looking at the four-manifold perspective. OK, are there any questions?
Is that just a statement that SU2 is not connected as a Lie group?
It is connected. It just has this interesting topology. I mean, like,
it doesn't have holes.
It does, right? It's like it's a big ball with the.
So it's like basically like. So these connections assemble in like classes. So the large gauge transformation would be like if I go from the trivial class to another class, I guess.
That's what it will do on the four manifold. Like if I'm on a four manifold, you can build a gauge field by saying, well, it's trivial over here, it's trivial over here, and the gluing data is going to be some gauge transformation. And if it's a topologically non-trivial one like this, what you will build is a topologically non-trivial field configuration, like an instanton. So this thing is exactly, and so in fact, the original formula for the very first instanton written down by Polyakov, like you used a gauge transformation just like this. So in answer to your question, like why is it topologically non-trivial? Well, it's just like the winding number. I have a circle, I have another circle can wind around it some number of times, and that number is a topological invariant. It's just like that, but except it's a higher dimensional version. So it's harder to picture it, but.
Yeah. So what would happen if I took three-dimensional Chern-Simons on a manifold with boundary, which is a two-dimensional boundary, then this small gauge transformation would give me some problem, right? Or?
Yes, absolutely. This is an excellent point. Yeah, so if you looked at this gauge transformation, you would have to take care of these boundary terms, and then one of them would be this one. Let's see. So what you would have to make a gauge invariant system, you would have to impose some constraints on the gauge field on the boundary, like you would normally normally you would ask for half of the components to vanish because you want it to be in a Lagrangian. But you might also ask that the gauge transformations vanish on the boundary too. That way you could build a gauge invariant system with boundary.
Right, but am I allowed to like restrict my gauge transformations like this?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you get to make up the action. You get to make up the gauge transformations. And the main constraint is like, so you might say, like, well, what's the problem? Like, why do we need gauge transformations at all? You need gauge transformations because the kinetic term is degenerate, and you need something to cancel that. But if you set up your boundary condition and your gauge transformations so that the kinetic term remains non-degenerate with your restricted gauge transformations, then you're fine.
Kenny?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure that I understand properly. So this is like the large gain transformation will be, so this is like S3 to SE2, right? Which is also S3, so like it will be like, the homotopy group will be like Z. So basically, like the small gauge transformation will be like I'm staying in the same homotopy group, but I'm shifting a little
exactly,
bit.
Exactly, yes.
The larger will be like I'm going to an okay.
Yeah, exactly. So the large gauge, large gauge transformations is just a kind of physics-y word for saying it's a non-trivial, lives in a non-trivial homotopy class. So to understand, I'll give a kind of very sketchy derivation. The effect of large gauge transformations now, let me say this better, actually. Yeah, sorry. Suppose F, let's call it say, yeah. Sigma S3 SE2 is my gauge transformation. Then the variation of the the trivial connection which has A equals 0 gets sent to by sigma the connection sigma inverse d sigma, because that's the formula for the gauge transformation. So we need to look at the Trin-Simons action of sigma inverse d sigma. You know, obviously the trivial connection gets zero. This connection is going to be something which is not zero, and we'd like to figure out what it is. And it's going to be something which measures the topology of this map. So something like the winding number. And we can calculate that. Sigma d sigma inverse d sigma plus 1/3 So there's going to be several ways to figure this out. I'm just kind of presenting one way right now. So you know how to differentiate an inverse, but you may not know this formula. I don't know if you know it. This is a formula for differentiating the inverse of a matrix, because they don't commute. So we get this 1 over sigmas on both sides. So actually, these two things are basically the same. So it's too lazy to work out the constant right now. It's proportional to trace inverse d sigma cubed. Now, on the manifold, SU2, S3, there is a volume form. It has a natural volume form invariant under all the symmetries. And it's basically this. How to write this? So you'll have to take it on faith for a moment. So that this expression, sorry, cubed, really is the volume form in S3. But if you believe that, that's a little thing. What if we determined
is that volume form to do with like the Hall measure on SU2?
Yes. Yeah, it's the bi-invariant volume form. Okay. So another way to describe it is, you know, I need to give it the free form. So at every point in SU2, I need to give something in the exterior cube of the cotangent model. But because I want it to be invariant under the left and right actions, you might as well take that point to be the identity. And then the tangent space is the Lie algebra, and then there's a natural way to contract three elements of the Lie algebra. And this is the global expression for it. So in any case, we conclude that the Chern-Simons form for sigma inverse d sigma is proportional to, so the integral for S3, the integral over S3 of the pullback under sigma of the volume form on SU2. So this number the 3D version of the winding number. So you guys remember this formula for the winding number? If I have a function, you can figure out how many times it winds around by looking at the integral of d log. This is the same thing, except in three dimensions. So this is, it's if you normalize it correctly, it's an integer which measures how many times we wrap as 3. Okay, so what's our conclusion is, under large gauge transformations, the Chern-Simons form changes, well, the integral of the Chern-Simons form changes by an integer. So we're still gauge invariant as long as, well, it's an integer kind of times factors of pi. Oh, we have to the normalization is off, not being careful. So we have to, as long as we've suitably normalized our Chern-Simons function, because we have an e to the I when we're doing the path integral, this will drop out. So. This expression even under large gauge transformations. Okay, any questions about this discussion? I didn't tell you where I didn't tell you how to figure out the normalization because I was lazy about some factors. But you can figure that out by thinking about the four-dimensional picture, for instance. Other than that, are there any? Okay.
So since it drops out from like pass integral, it enters the physics by requiring that we still have to gauge fix. How it enters the physics.
Like how does this, how do these large gate transformations enter?
No. So how does the, so this has like effect on like 3D theory, right?
Yes.
But like it drops out from the pass integral.
Like which drops out from the large gate transformations drop out? You still do the path integral.
Oh yeah, just
when you divide by these large gate transformations.
Yeah.
So to make things really concrete, let me explain what happens in the case of U1. Of course, U1 is a little bit different because the group U1 is not three-dimensional, it's one-dimensional. So we can't really talk about this 3D version of winding number. We should talk again about the familiar one-dimensional winding number. But other than that, the story is the same. So my gauge group is U1. My manifold is something like S1 times sigma. Theta is a coordinate on S1. And suppose I do a large gauge transformation. Then the gauge variation of any connection is varies by 2 pi I d theta. There's going to be a factor of I missing somewhere probably. Has to do with the normalization of the trace on U1. So in any case, the gauge variation is something like this. So the Chern-Simons form, ADA, is this sense to get sent to 2 pi I d theta dA. 2 pi I d theta times the field strength of A, because A is an abelian connection. So the variation of the integral of the Trin-Simons action is integral over S1 2 pi I d theta, and the integral over my surface of the field strength of A. So it's proportional to just the integral over the surface of the field strength. But this is quantized. Because this, you know, if I'm in dimension 2, I have a gauge field in dimension 2. This field strength just measures an integer, which is like some kind of vorticity or something like that. So again, you get the normalizations correct. You can just see very explicitly that when you have the correct normalization and you exponentiate the action, everything really is gauge invariant. So let me spend maybe a few minutes on other similar kind of terms which are kind of topological, which are quantized. Suppose that's good to do something you're familiar with already. If M is a symplectic manifold, and I have some particle, maybe from S1 to M, or maybe OR to M, we can extend gamma to a map from a manifold of one dimension higher. And then we can add on integral gamma tilde star omega where I take on the manifold of one dimension higher, I pull back the two form. This makes sense. This is independent of choices. If this, the integral over whenever I integrate this over a two-cycle, I get an integer. So if the area of any two-cycle is an integer. So this should be really familiar, right? We've had exactly this condition before. And we've had very similar expressions before. So if omega is d alpha, this is just the integral over the boundary of gamma star alpha, which we've seen before as, you know, this is how we build a Lagrangian from the phase space. So this tells us that this expression here is a way to encode to Lagrangian for a particle in the phase space in general. So I was writing this because I hoped you could see that there was some similarities with the way one builds the Chern-Simons action. And since we're on the topic, I should explain. Now, it should be obvious now that you can write such a term for sigma models in various dimensions. So, if say n is a D manifold, and X is a manifold with a D plus one form, which is closed, D omega is zero, and the integral of omega over any D plus one manifold, if this integral is an integer. So this condition really means that this is an integral cohomology class. If sigma n d to x is a field, we can have a term in the action called the Wessimino term. Yeah, so this is like a term of the action of the sigma model in any dimension, which arises whenever you have some topological feature of the target geometry. And it's to do, it kind of, it's on the bulk manifold of one dimension higher, it measures winding, again, in some sense. This was originally introduced a long time ago, just for general cultural knowledge. So people since the 60s like to model QCD as a sigma model whose target is the flavor symmetry group, which is SU3. The idea is if I take a pair of fermions in QCD, you know, they transform as a matrix in SU3, then you can treat that as a fundamental field. It's called like the pion model. Now, QCD has this, the ABJ anomaly appears in QCD to do with the SU3 flavor symmetry. And this term is introduced to model it in the sigma model. So that's why Weiss and Zimino were interested in it. So let's go back to Trans-Simons theory, unless there's any questions. Yeah?
So what is it, the dimension of x?
X can be any dimension.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't actually matter all that much. The dimensionality of this D-manifold is much more important, because in low dimensions, the sigma model is fairly well behaved, but in high dimensions, it's very non-normalizable. So let's study the phase space of Trans-Simons. On the manifold, which is S1 times S1 times or, this is time, and the gauge group is U1. So we've seen the equations of motion tell us we have a flat So the phase space is always the space of solutions to the equations of motion. So what we're going to do is we're just going to calculate that. Solutions to the equations of motion up to gauge symmetry. So my gauge field looks like A1 d theta 1. And this satisfies satisfy these zero curvature equations. But these are taken up to gauge transformations. Which are infinitesimally delta A is d theta I del chi del theta I dt. So what happens here is, I don't know if this is really, really obvious to you, but you can always choose a gauge transformation which gets rid of this one and makes A1 and A2 constant. We can set AT equals 0 and A1 equals some constant. So this requires that the field strength vanishes. So is this are you okay with this statement? I mean, the way, how would you do this? It's a very concrete thing. You know, I have these functions of theta and t. Well, firstly, you get, obviously get rid of this one. That's very easy. And then I'm left with functions of theta 1 and theta 2, satisfying the zero curvature equation. And I want to write, you know, given this equation, I want to say a1 is a derivative of something, and a2 is a derivative of the same thing. So this equation is precisely what you need to be able to do that. But that basically a, you write chi as like an integral of in basically the formula is something like chi of theta is integral naught to theta of a1. But then you want chi to be periodic, so you run into trouble unless the integral of a1 vanishes. So what you can do is you can just remove the part whose integral vanishes, leaving a constant. Okay, so then we see phase space looks like, say, C1 d theta 1, C2 d theta 2, where C1, C2 are independent of theta. So really these are just, so C1 is the integral over theta 1 of A1, C2 is the integral theta 2 of A2. Okay. And the final step is large gauge transformations. So let me call these Q1 and Q2. Send QI to QI plus 1. So we conclude the phase space is S1 times S1. And E, the 2 pi I Q1, is equal to a Wilson line in Chern-Simons, which wraps the theta 1 cycle. And similarly for E to the 2 pi I Q2. So the coordinates in the phase space, we no longer have this familiar thing where I have position and momentum. Momentum is time derivative of position. Instead, the coordinates on the phase space are much more symmetrical. The two natural coordinates are Wilson lines wrapping different circles. This is my torus. This is my 2. Okay. So any questions about how we got here? course, I haven't written down the commutation, the Poisson bracket yet, but I can write it in a sec. Yeah.
So does this happen basically because the kinetic term is A wedge dA, so when I differentiate with respect to dA, I get A, so the momentum really is position.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Yeah, any time the, yeah, if you only have one derivative in the kinetic term, then the phase space never includes a variable corresponding to time derivative. So this is also true if you consider a system of fermions, because the Dirac equation is a first order equation. The phase space for fermions, it's like a supermanifold, but it only has the fermions themselves and not their derivatives in it. Okay, so maybe the fact which we'll derive next time. Is that the Poisson bracket between Q1 and Q2 is going to be equal to K, where this is the Chern-Simons coupling constant. Sorry, is this K or 1 over K? One over K. Okay, so here we see another reason for the quantization of this coupling constant. That the symplectic form is dQ1 dQ2 times K, and this must be quantized. In fact, we saw exactly this system a couple of weeks ago, where we talked about it in terms of position and momentum, both of which were periodic. And we found, okay, you can write down canonical commutation relations, but if you want to build a representation of that algebra, you need that the coefficient here, right here in front of the symplectic form, has to be an integer. And then the number of states in the system was roughly the volume of this phase space. So when we did it before, it seemed a bit strange that we were making momentum periodic. But the Chern-Simons Lagrangian is one of the places where that appears naturally. Okay, and this computation here of the commutation relations is not actually difficult, and we can do it next time.